Welcome to The Secret Truth. I'm George Butler. Along with me this evening is Tony Gosling from Bristol, England. And we're going to bring you up to date on some really good stories out of the UK. And also there's one or two out of the European Union. Welcome to our program, Tony Gosling.
Thanks ever so much. For always appreciate getting a call from you, George, because over here I'm finding it increasingly difficult to do my job as a journalist. I mean, this is, you know, it's like a wall of lies, and people like me are having more and more difficulty actually punching through that wall.
Yes. You know, there's more and more censorship happening on all levels. You know, Facebook has this algorithm. I'm not seeing on my news feed on Facebook, I'm not seeing nearly the explosive news articles that I saw just months ago or several months ago. How about yourself?
Well, yes, exactly the same. And I would just point to one article, which was originally on Washington's blog, which there's a really good, on Medium.com, there's a really good article on there with somebody who tried to share this article on Facebook. And it's absolutely, the thing with Washington's blog, one of the things I love about it, and I've written one article for it, so I am slightly biased, but what they did, it's a privately funded blog. It's brilliant, I think, because I wrote an article for them, and they sent it back to me, George, and they said, there's not enough links in here, yeah? Can you put some more links in? Yeah, so the idea being is right throughout an article, especially if you're writing about something contentious, anyone that's reading it that thinks, oh, I doubt that, they can just click through to the evidence from the blog.
Now, that's good, yeah.
It's really good. It's, you know, that gives it robustness and integrity that the mainstream media and actually quite a lot of the alternative media lack. You know, the idea that you can stand a story up. Washington's blog will not publish stuff, at least, you know, certainly that's what I've seen in the past. And with my experience with them, my article was about the 7/7 London bombings. And it was one of, I think, the most comprehensive looks at all of the various aspects of 7/7. It's not been endorsed by these victims' families, but I've been doing interviews with these people with their total knowledge of the article. So they aren't endorsing the article, but they're certainly not afraid to talk to me because of having written this. And all of the stuff in there, George, including the infiltrator, that's what it was described by the security services to the victims' families, a guy called Martin McDade. He was a special boat service, special forces, and he was working with two of the four London bombers, Mohammed Siddiqui Khan and Jazad Tanweer, I think it was, but that he was taking them to Cumbria, the Lake District and other places in Britain to actually train them. So this is a former British Forces, Royal Navy, special boat service guy, special forces, and apparently now he's vanished. That's what everyone tells me, but of course, this is extremely suspicious that you've got British Special Forces training people who later then go on to bomb London and kill over 50 people on the underground system. Of course, this bit of news has hardly made it through to anywhere, in fact, but it's, you know, I've referenced it on there. So what I'm saying is Washington's blog published this, what I thought was a really good article, just I'm not sure about how long ago it was, but it was picked up by various other websites, and it's all about these false flag attacks, and it's documenting one after the other after the other after the other after the other, and it's quite clear that the actual article is called False flags are just a conspiracy theory. Admitted fact, question mark. And that's on Washington's blog. The actual article itself is on Educate, Inspire, Change. And it's the headline they've given, the same article, is for those who don't believe in conspiracies, here are 58 admitted false flag attacks. Now, the article on Medium.com, what it did was it explained, and it showed screenshots of the various messages that Facebook sent back to this user of that article, explaining why, well, no, it didn't explain why, it just said this article contravenes our community guidelines, and therefore you have been blocked from posting for a certain amount of time, and the post has been removed, blah, blah. So what's happening now is the mainstream media have got everybody with any brains onto social media, because that's the only way we can share good information about what's going on in the world. The mainstream corporate press is just simply not doing that. And now what they're doing is they're starting to pick off people one by one on social media, and I don't doubt it's not just Facebook that are doing this. Certainly there's been a lot of talk of YouTube also taking videos down, which, and also demonetizing people who have been posting good stuff. And so that's, I think, really where we are now, is they're starting to close down the big social, the big tech giants are starting to close down social media too. So just be aware that what you're seeing there, there is a great deal of interference in it. I'm sure you are, George, but this is a great bit of practical evidence that, that's actually happened.
Yeah, it's getting to be where they finally discovered that the web has a two-edged sword, and it can reveal and expose their inner workings of their networks and their power system. So
With what's happened in Zimbabwe, I think it's been fascinating for us, because this is a former British colony, a lot of fighting going on back in the late 70s, early 80s, between the British government and ZANU-PF and the, you know, the revolutionaries down there in what was Rhodesia, now Zimbabwe. But the way it's been reported, I think, is just a classic example of modern propaganda. So what they do is they're saying, isn't it wonderful, Mugabe's being overthrown, isn't it wonderful? And when it comes to, I think it's Emmanuel Mnangagwa, the guy that's taken over, only once he's been installed as president does the media start to tell you, oh yes, well he's the guy who's behind all these various massacres. So it's a textbook bit of propaganda, bigging up the idea of overthrowing the president, only to tell the public afterwards that the guy that's replaced him is a maniac.
Man, you know, where are we going to end up on this? We're going to end up with just a tyranny controlling the high technology, you know?
Well, certainly there's definitely a big attempt, I think, in the last 6-8 months. I would suggest since the introduction of the Hitler's birthday algorithm by Google back in April, that there is definitely an attempt to control what the internet news. Okay, so by massively down list some really important, excellent websites. I mean, there are still some fantastic stuff out there. For example, I mean, I can just give you a few examples. The Intercept in Brazil is brilliant. They're breaking stories all the time. And another one which is quite good, I like a lot, is antiwar.com. I mean, he's not a 9/11 truther, but a lot of the stuff he does on there is really tight, very, very well argued, again, often linked and referenced, which is what you need. But when you say, where are we heading? Well, I think it's pretty obvious to me that there's we've seen the groundwork laid in the Middle East through the Bush and Blair illegal invasion of Iraq. And we now hear just this week that there are something like, I think it was 1,700 US troops in Syria, even though they haven't actually been properly declared by the Pentagon, and also that there has been no resolution in Congress to allow them to go to Syria, and no UN resolution to allow them to be there. And yet they're there, and what they'll be doing is training still the so-called rebel forces, who have been responsible, it looks like now, for all of the chemical weapons attacks we've seen, the two major ones at Ghouta and Idlib. These are the people we're still sponsoring. So as ISIS and al-Nusra are slowly being crushed by the Russians and by Assad, by the legitimate regime there, the government, elected, by the way, unlike Saudi Arabia. So as they're being crushed, there's a new front's opening. But I noticed just in one of the news services this week, I can't remember which one it was, George, but that there were reports in China, this is translated from China, I think it was Middle East Monitor, that the Chinese are now talking about, they're actually planning to send ground forces to Syria. And this is a result of the US is illegally keeping, I would imagine the Brits are there too, of course, but they're keeping it very, very quiet, the Brits. And we've got effectively a MI6 government here in Britain, with Theresa May being the security services choice, MI5 she oversaw for many years, and helped cover up things like the 7/7 bombings, for example, without organising a proper inquiry into that, even though there were people lobbying her to do so, who I've spoken to. So there needs to be obviously an overhaul of the security services in Britain. There isn't any proper look at that. But what I'm saying here is, the fact that they've managed to smuggle British troops, and certainly we know 1,700 US troops into Syria, means that, of course, the other members of the UN Security Council are going to look at this and say, well, you can't just do this without us having a reaction. That's why the Russians came in 2015, and why it looks like the Chinese are going to be boots on the ground in Syria now too.
Right. You know, this tax bill passed late last night, early this morning, through the Senate. And it looked like Trump's going to put in a new tax law, reform tax law. So that was a big win for him, even though it's a mixed bag, I think, for about everybody.
Look, you know, the great massive increase in military spending.
I know, yet, it doesn't weigh out, you know. It won't work, you know.
So what it will do is it will increase the national debt massively. I mean, the thing is, I worry about Trump. I really worry about this guy. I think, you know, most people thought, look, he's a new broom. He's someone who's from the world of big business, and let's give him a chance, because we know Hillary Clinton is an extremely dodgy quantity.
We don't want her. That's why people vote. Even Democrats voted for Trump, because they didn't want Hillary in there.
Well, look, for the record, Trump did not win the election. Hillary Clinton stole the election from Bernie Sanders for Donald Trump.
And actually, she opened up.
Democracy work. They don't work, you know, because she stole the nomination from Sanders.
They actually opened up opportunity.
Can you imagine what it would be like with Sanders in charge now?
Oh, my gosh. But, you know.
But it'd be.
Look, you can't give everything to everybody, you know. I mean, you know, things cost, too.
We need to have administrations that are looking after their domestic population. What it seems at now, and of course the whole of the world looks at the US presidential elections with whilst biting its fingernails, because what happens in the US determines a lot of what happens in the rest of the world. It seems to me that there's not hardly any focus from the White House on domestic policy in getting US citizens feeling good, being paid well, in decent work, with good amounts of disposable income. Remember the 1960s, the 1970s, absolutely massive disposable income. The US was one of the highest in the whole world. Here in Britain was pretty good too, but America had an amazing employment record, you know, almost everybody with a job, and also enormous amounts of surplus income to spend on having a nice time and relaxing, and also being able to change jobs whenever they wanted to. If they decided they didn't like their boss, they could go and get a job somewhere else easily. So they've taken that away from us since the 70s, and effectively now I think the Western world is run by the banks, by the banksters, and by the people who... They're effectively, the government are in these banks. The big corporations are far bigger and more powerful than the governments. And they've been emaciated deliberately because there's an attempt at an oligarchy. Well, I mean, it is an oligarchy now, effectively, with the bankers and the big businesses running the show.
They are. The big business is the corporate thing, the Davos people. You know, they're all in there running everything. And the Bilderberg, you've documented that for years. They talk about the Logan Act, you know. They never use that.
Remind everyone that it's going to be, it looks like in Venice, which is the first full weekend in June, on an island. So if you've got a sailboat or something, or, you know, whatever, make sure it's over in the Mediterranean and chugging up to Venice.
Can I sail in there on my yacht from out of Texas?
Where they're meeting is an interesting place they're meeting. It's an island. It's called something like Bag Island, because Waste Bag Island, something like that, which is obviously not very romantic sounding.
Waste Bag Island, is that what?
I can check and just double check to see exactly what that island is they're meeting on. But they've tried to rename it. The hotel, the Marriott chain, who bought the island, have tried to rename it. The only trouble is the Venice citizens haven't really taken any notice of them, so they still call it by its original name, which is, I'll just bring
that up. How about Paradise Island or something like that?
What's it called? The Island of Roses.
Yeah, right. Island of Roses. I like that.
Nobody's really calling it that. That's right. It's called Scoop Bag Island.
Oh, my God.
Casasola, right? So this is in the Lagoon of Venice, which is where the Bilderbergers are going to be meeting. And it was actually built in 1870 with a whole load of rubble dumped from a new canal which was being built in Venice. So this is, whatever, you know 140, 50 years old, this island. And it's just built on rubble. But anyway, so that's where they're going to be. The idea, of course, being that they're well away from everyone else. But look, well worth reminding everyone that Bilderberg is not actually the command post of the New World Order. What I would suggest is a more powerful organisation is Circle, which is the Pinay Circle, which is much more secretive than Bilderberg.
Catholic Habsburg based or something way back.
Well, it's made up of the far right politicians, some of them serving politicians, many of them retired politicians, and effectively it's a fascist international. So the fascists like to talk about themselves, and people like to think of the far right as being something which is nationalistic. Well, it's not. I've got news for you. The international oligarchy elite have very much got together, and they want to defend their wealth. They're making vast amounts of wealth, some of them far more than they can ever spend. But still, they're obsessed with saving it all for themselves and not sharing it with the people that really need it. So that's effectively what their mission is, and they want to constantly be grabbing more territory, more resources all the time. And the Bilderberg is more of a kind of recruiting service for big political posts and other, major positions like IMF. So what they'll do is effectively bring people into Bilderberg, and everyone will have a look at them. The elite, people like Kissinger, will say, "Oh, this guy." And then maybe they're allowed to sit next to Kissinger at the Saturday dinner, In which case, they're probably going to be the next president. So it's that kind of event, really. But these are fascinating people to talk to, and you can usually get to chat to them on the way between the airport and, in this case, the island.
Right. There was a service out of the Netherlands that started exposing a lot of those inner circles like that, and David Rockefeller was a member of the Circle at one time. But his Chase Manhattan Bank.
Also in British politics, Jonathan Aitken.
Yes.
He is a super far right. He was a super far right MP, Conservative MP. But it was always the ones who were on the far, far right of the party. Another one's Michael Ancram. Really authoritarian. With the Conservative Party, you've got a kind of Christian wing, which is fairly authoritarian, but they're also, there's a kind of moral side to it, whereas these guys are completely opposite end of the party. So they just see authoritarian as the way to do things, and they don't really accept or listen to any criticism. That's very much like what Bilderberg is like. They are absolutely not interested in hearing any criticism or any other points of view. They've got a fixed point of view, and they want to keep well away from anyone that might critique it. Now, of course, that is totally anti-democratic, and it explains why they have an obsession with closing down people like me, the media, anyone that's actually telling the truth and giving opposite points of view from an intellectual point of view gets shut down. I mean, one thing I'd say about the European Union this week is we've had this long protracted in a negotiation, they call it. I don't know. It just seems to me to be a bunch of hoops that the Brussels people, Barnier and the rest of them, are trying to force David Davis and the rest of Liam Fox and Theresa May to jump through. And they've said it in no uncertain terms. They've said, well, look, unless we can agree on this divorce bill, we're not going to be talking about trade at all. And so that is not a negotiation, George.
Right.
What they're saying is, unless you do what we say, because that's what an agreement is.
We're going to boycott England. Yeah.
So they've agreed this week, Theresa May's had to agree, really, to pay a £45 billion bill.
Right, I saw that. Man.
Now, a lot of people are saying, well, actually, we don't owe you guys anything. Because we've been paying in all the way through, and this divorce bill is just simply a arbitrary ticket that you
blackmail. What it is?
It's a kind of blackmail. It's saying, well, look, we're not going to talk to you unless you pay this. Well, I don't think people would have been very impressed if the Brits had said that to Brussels. And what they're implying is that we need them more than they need us. Well, that's actually not a very sensible, helpful, friendly negotiation. But in a way, it's exactly the sort of reaction you'd expect from a totalitarian and authoritarian.
Exactly, Tony. Right.
Like, for example, Brussels' relationship with Catalonia and the separatists in Catalonia too. You know, they have voted to leave, but Brussels is saying, we support you, we support the government police clampdown and arrest of the democratic president. So anyway, that's another question. But I think this divorce bill, also, it's interesting to see, when we agreed to pay it, or when Theresa agreed to pay it this week, there was a big jump in the pound. Well, I'd say a fairly, you know, quite a reasonable jump in the value of the pound. And I think this is the way that the world works nowadays. This is not a normal, natural, you know, reaction of ordinary people around the world saying the pound is worth. This is a reward by the financial banksters, who's like sending signals through the markets to individual politicians and financial journalists to say, you've done something right. Yeah? It's a real simple sign, and I don't think it really... That's where we are, I think, with the financial markets. They're so controlled, a vast amount of money, that as soon as you do something that the financial oligarchy feels right, then your currency will do a bit better. So that's where we are with that one, George.
Well, I tell you... We've got so much going on over here. Actually, you know, we talk about the Gladio. You've got a UK Gladio, it sounds like. They're throwing acid in people's faces over there in London. What's that about?
Well, I'm not really sure where this has come from. Who has put people up to this? Difficult to know. I'll say is it certainly looks to me as if there has been some kind of, you know, provocation for these people to do this. The provocation, I suppose, is there's quite a lot of propaganda circulating about Muslims generally, which is, you know, it's exacerbated by the British government. It's also, by the way, exacerbated by Donald Trump retweeting the far-right tweets from Britain First. Now, let me just explain to people, Britain First has got nothing to do with Britain, or... I mean, actually, you had America First, didn't you, in the Second World War over there, which was run by the Nazis. This is what Britain First is, rather similar. And that's what they were trying to keep America out of the war. And, you know, that's, you know, may have been a good thing for a while, but certainly, you know, it's basically a far-right front. And many of the... images that they circulate, videos they circulate, are either fabricated or they're from sources which are not the sources that they're telling you. So the problem with the retweeting of the Britain First tweets by Trump was that he should have recognised that this really is a fascist, neo-fascist organisation, far-right organisation that doesn't represent any kind of sane criticism of the Islamic terrorism that's been going on, Islamist terrorism. The Gladio terrorism. So what Trump should have done, if he had any sense himself or good advisors himself, we should immediately have backtracked on that and said, I apologise for retweeting that. It's the wrong type of thing to be retweeting. Because people in Britain know who Britain First is. It doesn't seem that White House has any idea who they are. So there's all sorts of things. There's another thing which is a provocation, really, which has been done by MI5. They put a story out, and the police... in Britain, saying that although we've got 300 or so people returning from the Middle East who have been trained by ISIS back to Britain. They're not going to be stops at the airport, not going to be arrested, and they're not going to be interrogated. So there could be no charges against them, even though it would be actually fairly simple for them to be charged. And the reason, I think, is, number one, is to create the possibility for false flag attacks, a Gladio-style attacks, and then also because if these people were to come to court, then they may well just say, well, I was recruited by MI6, George.
Right, you know? Right.
So it's a terrifically embarrassing situation that the British are in, where they've got all these trained terrorists coming into Britain, coming back to Britain, but they can't do anything about it because it would be too embarrassing if their crookery and the fact that they've been behind a lot of the proxy wars in the Middle East was to come out in court.
Right. What do you have, you know, the arrest of these high-level Saudis over in Saudi Arabia? What's going on over there now? I know Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman has been behind all this, right?
Okay, so I think what we're seeing in Saudi Arabia is a slow crumbling of the regime, actually. This is measures of desperation. It's becoming more authoritarian. The people who were allies of the Saudi Arabia being arrested and interrogated, possibly, or it looks like tortured as well. So I think it's a bit like what my colleague Martin Summers calls a glass tower. It's starting to fracture.
Right.
It may be also that, because imagine really what's going on in Yemen and in Saudi Arabia, because these countries were set up by Britain in the Sykes-Picot and French in the Sykes-Picot Agreement. Effectively, it's a civil war on the Arabian Peninsula. That's what's really going on. And what's happened is the Brits and the Americans have backed the despot, you know, because that's what they do in the Middle East. And they're saying that the government of Saudi Arabia is legitimate, Bahrain is legitimate. Well, the people in those countries don't actually think that, even though they may be afraid to say it. So I think what we're seeing is a slow disintegration of Saudi Arabia, a rather worrying trend when you think of the amount of weaponry that they've now got, mostly from the US. And it's really interesting, isn't it? I don't know if you saw on Thursday, the European Parliament voted to ban all weapon sales from the European Union to Saudi Arabia. So absolutely amazing decision, particularly considering that Britain and America seem to be one of the only things that's propping up the arms firms in the US and the UK is the Saudis buying loads of weapons for the Yemen war and other war.
Right. Have you heard this theory about Vegas and the Saudis and they're tying up together? That's what actually was Vegas was about on the shooting on the October 1. Have you heard those theories?
I've heard that there were some leaks supposedly from the FBI, but I've not been able to corroborate them. So maybe you can enlighten me, George.
Well, you know, we've got these people that have zeroed in on the Las Vegas shooting, and they're saying that actually they were playing out the conflict between the pro-Solomon, King Solomon forces and the anti-King Solomon forces. And that's what spilled over in their attack on the crowd.
Well, that's totally possible.
And it was a diversion, the crowd.
I think one of the most likely kind of scenarios there is that there was some sort of dodgy arms deal going on, but that that somebody amongst the intelligence people involved in that or the...
Well, the best idea now, Tony, on the number of arms in Paddock's room is that those arms are going to be distributed to a hit team that was going to go on and invade the upper floors and take out some higher-level Saudis, princes. That's what sort of the thinking is now. There's helicopters that enter into this thing, too, firing, and also helicopters that have their signals turning on and off and all that. They're transponders with false signals at times. So it's really fascinating. No one has quite a hold on this. Even Oleg Domagard still says that this is complicated and he hasn't figured it out yet. It's not an easy thing to look at.
No, definitely not. All we can be sure, I think, yeah. of is that Stephen Paddock wasn't responsible.
Exactly. He wasn't scapegoat on this. He was.
He was executed, I think, in that room.
I mean, exactly.
He does fit the profile of someone who would do that sort of thing. He also fits the profile of the sort of person that may have been working quite closely with the Secret Services, and they may have wished to get rid of him. He was also very knowledgeable about the financial affairs of Lockheed Martin, you know, so he's the sort of guy, I think, who would make, for them, a convenient patsy, possibly. But look, I just want to say, before I go, something
yeah.
about what's been going on in Germany, because
yeah,
it's got zero coverage
okay.
almost anywhere apart from in Germany, but it's an incredibly important story. Because back in, I'm not sure whether it was April, I think it was around about the last weekend in April, 30th of April, there was an amazing story about a German soldier being arrested for planning a false flag terror attack on Vienna Airport, so that refugees would take the blame. This is all around the news services, you know, mainstream news and everything. The interesting thing about the case was the German soldier apparently was posing as a Syrian refugee. And he had basically a double identity. So he was a lieutenant in the German army, but he was also pretending to be an asylum seeker, a Syrian refugee. He was planning an attack on Vienna Airport to murder people in the airport and then to leave a kind of trail so that people, the police in Austria, would be following this Syrian refugee. But actually all the time he was doing it for the German army. Anyway, just the other day, he was released. So Deutsche Welle reported that a soldier suspected of planning a terrorist attack disguised as a refugee has been released due to insufficient evidence. Now, why insufficient evidence? Well, I can tell you why. It's because the military will not have been telling anyone anything about this guy and what he was really up to. He's called Franco A, F-R-A-N-C-O-A, so they haven't even named the guy. And it's drawn attention to right-wing extremists among the German army ranks. This, to me, is a very much a modern Gladio attack. And I have no doubt that the police, what happens in these cases, the police generally tend to go in and do a good job. What then happens is the intelligence services move in, and the courts move in, and then they stop the progress of justice. And that's seems to be on the surface of it anyway, what exactly what's happened here. The Bundeswehr has got to do something about this kind of thing. And it is, the thing is, it links up with the Oktoberfest, I think it was in the late 1970s, early 80s attack, which was another false flag attack under the Gladio, which happened in Germany. And I just think we've really got to be aware that this is what's going on. Key thing is exactly as in Britain under VIP defiles, exactly as in Spain under what's happened with Catalonia and the fascist corruption of the People's Party in Spain, is we don't have a functioning justice system. We saw also, didn't we, this week, the suicide of the Bosnian Croat leader guy from Yugoslavia. Amazing scenes in the tribunal for the former Yugoslavia.
Oh, yes, he took poison there, yeah.
George, that was incredible, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was. That's a one-time, first-time thing, wasn't it?
But you know, the thing is with this, again, it's a kangaroo court, this. The people who really should be on trial for what happened in Yugoslavia are whole bunch of NATO officers who planned the thing in the first place. The thing, also the massacre in Srebrenica.
Yes.
The British were supposed to be bringing in air support, and at the last minute, nothing happened. And you know, there were all sorts of, you know, the plans are. If NATO headquarters could be opened up by the International Criminal Court, I don't think there'd be any of the senior generals left outside jail.
Yeah, I'm all in the docks, man. Tell you. It's terrible what's happening. The real truth out there about what's going on, most of the people don't want to listen to it sometimes, Tony.
I think there's also, you know, this guy Slobodan Praljak, I'm not saying he was a nice guy. All I'm saying is he was way down the food chain when it came to war crimes in Yugoslavia. I mean, the thing is with Yugoslavia, maybe the people in the US don't realise, it was actually a brilliant model of marrying communism and capitalism in a kind of very sensible socialist society where you had a lot of workers' rights. So, for example, you had any large organisations had the workers, if they didn't like, if they didn't think the guy who was running their factory was any good, they could vote him out and vote someone else in. And that actually worked really well in the car factories and things like that in Yugoslavia. And the other thing is, it meant that there was a kind of camaraderie and esprit de corps in the industry in Yugoslavia, which wasn't seen in capitalist countries or communist countries, because of they're both more authoritarian in their various ways. I mean, authoritarian capitalism, that, you know, basically the owner of the place decides everything. In Yugoslavia, they had a different model, which was a kind of bit of both, really. And it was a very successful constitution. Anyone should study, you know, just studying constitutions should have a good look at the old Tito constitution. Tito, of course, had 800,000 partisans in World War II. The end of the war, 1948-49, Stalin turned up on the doorstep with a whole army of his soldiers and said to Tito, you better do as we say, because we're moving in. And Tito said back to him, he said, if you dare to invade Yugoslavia, we will do exactly what we did to the Nazis, to you. So he was prepared to stand up to the Soviet Union and Stalin in exactly the same, because he was prepared to defend his country from Hitler. So a fascinating country and amazing model that was smashed to pieces by NATO, because it was providing another way of doing things that people might to copy.
Right. Well, I tell you what, I really enjoyed speaking this evening with you, Tony. Anything else to add on concluding or anything?
Yeah, I think the final one has got to be this article about the find exactly the right article, but it's about these 1,700 US troops illegally in Syria.
Oh, that's right, that's right.
The article, I think, is fascinating. I think it's from the Middle East Monitor, I think it's Justin Raimondo's antiwar.com, actually. And in that article, there's some fascinating figures to do, and he links through to everything, talking about how many US troops there are in Iraq. 9,000 or so. But one of the more interesting things he says is that there are 30,000 or so US troops around the world where there is no location declared for them.
My
God. There are all these, I mean, we know that there's something like 80 bases, US bases, maybe even more than that, but certainly 80 bases around the world. I mean, I don't know how many European Union bases there are in Britain. I think the answer is zero. But the way that the US wants to put these bases all around the world is not doing anything for world peace. That's the trouble in all of this. I'm just trying to look at the references about it, but I'm not absolutely sure about the numbers. But there's certainly far too many bases. That's right. Actually, no, it's 800. The Pentagon has 800 bases abroad.
My gosh.
Six declared in the UK. So what we're seeing is a real attempt to take over the world, effectively, by the US, which is in cahoots with Britain, of course, and other things like Israel. And I think we just need to be aware that we're living in a very dangerous age, and that we are now sitting in what was the equivalent in the 1930s of what could become a kind of police state, you know, like the fascist state was in Nazi Germany.
Right, that national security state has already been developed, and when they arrested General Flynn recently and questioned him, or when the FBI started questioning him before arresting or anything, they already had the transcripts of who he was talking with already. So, I mean, this is the way it's working these days. It's all recorded and intercepted, and these people are just already, you know, have a national security state, looks like to me.
That's, I mean, that's just why things like Bilderberg are important from their point of view.
Yeah.
Because they can speak face to face, they have a complete sweep, make sure there's no bugs anywhere.
Right.
Bilderberg will have all their bugs everywhere, no doubt. And that's why they have to meet face to face. Anyone that thinks otherwise is wrong. They can't do these sorts of things over Skype or on email. They have to set up their crooked deals and make their crooked promises face to face, George.
Right.
I just find people, we do the 9/11 forum, which is 911forum.org.uk.
Right.
And you can still pick up my shows, even though my FM show has been suspended for 2 weeks. Hope to be back next Friday. At thisweek.org.uk.
Okay. Well, thank you very much, Tony, for being with us this evening. We always enjoy all your input and your insight.
Cheers, George. All the best. God bless.
Okay. Cheers. Bye-bye. Good night. Thank you very much, Tony, for being with us this evening. I'll tell you what, there's just so much to cover these days. And I just wanted to elaborate a little bit more when I said about Las Vegas earlier in our conversation. But the Las Vegas thing is shaping up to be a possible confrontation between two groups. I will just delineate this. And I'm talking about the shooting occurring on October 1 in Las Vegas. And the Mandalay Bay Casino figures prominently in the country music festival that was going on that night, that evening. But basically, what's happening or what's shaping up is that in most researchers' minds, after viewing all the video and so forth, they're beginning to hypothesize or whatever, or theorize that there were possibly, we know that above Paddock's room, Paddock was staying on the 32nd floor, but above his room, all of those rooms were owned by a Four Seasons division that was dominated by the Saudis, and the Saudis really had first call on those rooms. So any high dignitaries or anything of the Saudi government and so forth would normally stay up there above where Paddock's room was. So we have basically, the way it's laying out is that we have helicopters that are on tape firing into the crowd. We have the log of those helicopters and what they were doing. We have helicopters turning on and off transponders, sometimes with fake ID numbers, faking a Southwest Airlines plane at one time. We have the helicopters firing somewhere on the crowd. We have machine gun fire, very low level sounding, which might indicate more of a belt driven machine gun, and then a higher shrill, which could have easily been an M16 or an AR-15 that was, converted over to machine gun fire. So we basically have shooting happening in different areas, okay, from different points of locations. We have black figures in some of the video. It looks like that they were blacked out. Some figures were. We have machine gun fire occurring from the Mandalay Bay in several places, sometimes above where Paddock's room was. We have helicopters possibly landing on the roof and extracting people. We have something that's going on between the pro-King Salman forces and the anti-King Salman forces. There were reports, I haven't seen verification of this, they allude to Saudi's Air Force coming in at the end of August into most of September or something, meeting there, in Las Vegas. But they're saying that there were top level, maybe the King or the Crown Prince were there that night on October 1st. If there's any truth to that, then there could have been an attack on either the King or his son, the Crown Prince. They're saying that maybe that the cover of firing into the crowd was to cover an attack on King Salman or his son, Crown Prince Mohammed bin Salman. So this was possibly, we have figures being escorted through casinos there that could have been possibly the Crown Prince. We don't have actual absolute proof. We have interpretations of photographs. We have witness accounts of shooting occurring in multiple locations along the strip there and from the different locations and clubs that were there. We have eyewitnesses there that could not discern exactly from where the shooting was taking place all the time because they believe there was multiple gunmen, multiple shooters firing from different directions. And there's one report that would substantiate that one man was shot from the lower back up through the front of his chest. Thank goodness it didn't take out any organs. But that particular report would indicate there was a ground level shooter also that was shooting in his direction. We have a lot of people that have looked at this. We have people that are dying already that were eyewitnesses, that were, you know, people that escaped out of the venue. They're alive. They're survivors, you could say. There are allegations that survivors are being taken down, you know, because of what they're saying. They put a lid on this. They don't want people talking about it. There's been all kinds of, you could say, there were three different scenarios of when the shooting occurred and when the security guard had this confrontation with Paddock. So there's three stories there. Jesus went on Ellen's show and espoused his particular view and first-hand view. We have two different photographs of security guards that look different. We have different photographs in restaurants of the security guard being awarded that look different. I mean, there's just nothing in this that is easy to look at. The Saudi confrontation between these two groups, where one was trying to take out the other, makes sense in a lot of different ways. But we're a long way from being able to solve this because there's been a national security, you know, mantle, you could say, veil placed over this. So they're discouraging anyone to talk, you know, authoritatively with anyone in the press and so forth. So that's basically what we have there in Vegas. The other news this week, just last night, late last night, early this morning, we had the Senate approve the tax reform bill. And, of course, with all kinds of different, you know what I mean, more the Schumer tried every trick in the book to delay and to cancel out this final decision early this morning. They introduced all kinds of motions to adjourn and motions to refer this over to back to committee or this and that and parts of it. But the Republicans stood shoulder to shoulder, and most votes were 52-48. So they had 100 there. Now the final vote for the bill was 51-49. Okay, Corker went over to the other side, I think was the vote that made it a little differently. So they would have had 52-48, but they did win with 51. And since there was not a tie, then Vice President Pence was there presiding over this particular ending of this bill. And so he would have been there to break a tie if there had been a tie. Fortunately for the Republicans, there was 51-49. Some things in this bill that I've seen, like some kind of a cap on interest for mortgage interest, don't like that. Overall, they made a mistake by limiting the number of tax, you know, brackets. And my way of thinking on that is that my way of thinking on that would have been to have more tax brackets. And I'll tell you why. They cut it down to, in this bill, to four tax brackets. And if you're at the top of any one of those tax brackets, and then all of a sudden you make another $100 and put you over into the next tax bracket, it can bump up that net, you know, tax to you far more than it would have if there'd been a gradual number of tax brackets. And that's what I would have favored, was a gradual rise instead of a sudden jumping up from 1 to 2 and 2 to 3 and 3 to 4. And I think that that was not well thought out. Capping real estate taxes and capping interest and so forth, I do not think that this is wise in this bill. The Democrats were there castigating it as stinking to high heaven. That was Schumer. Schumer's something else. He's very, very destructive person in the Senate. He's not totally for this country that I see. And so his suggestions and criticisms should not be listened to very much at all. That's what I think of Schumer. Otherwise, it did pass. It goes over now to the House, and there's a reconciliation committee that meets, and they have to reconciliate the two sides. The two bills are slightly different. And so they did throw out that Obama penalty, okay? The Senate bill did do away with that. Thank goodness we're going to stop penalizing people because they did not subscribe to Obama care or whatever they call it. And so that was totally unconstitutional as far as I'm concerned. But the Senate bill did throw that out of their version. Now, whether or not that will be retained in the final version, I'm not sure. They think that it will be, and it won't be touched by the House people. But they've got to put together now and a total bill that's agreeable, you know, and reconciliation and so forth is a way to go on it. And so it's right now it's still unknown exactly what the final bill will look like. We've had all kinds of other things going on in the country. This little gal, Kate Steinle, the trial over her murderer was just concluded out in San Francisco, and he's a 5-time man that was deported, Mexican national, deported, you know, he's a felon, several felon accounts over the years, and they did not convict him of even involuntary manslaughter, which many people said was a travesty of justice. And so they should have at least convicted him of involuntary manslaughter if the facts were as they were depicted and the gun went off. He said, you know, it still had to pull the trigger. But it did hit the pavement, the sidewalk or whatever, and did ricochet. And then it ricocheted, but it hit her in the back. And she did die of her injuries from that shot. So he's not denying that it was a gun that he said he found, that he did handle. He didn't deny all of that. So that was admitted to. And then basically it said that it went off somehow, whatever, and you know, managed to hurt this girl. We've had an ongoing sexual assault case from Harvey Weinstein forward. Al Franken got caught up in this. We've had Lauer, you know, there on the Today Show. And it's just, actually, it's getting rid, and it's of all these people that did not treat women properly. I mean, we think of the casting couch as a big problem over the years, you know what I mean, in Hollywood. And we've known about that. I mean, that's just a normal slang. The casting couch means that they would force women, you know, to have sex that because they want the part in the movie or the part on the television series or whatever it might be, you know. So, I mean, that's not right to start with. But that was just sort of the way that Hollywood worked for years. But it wasn't this obvious and it wasn't this extreme. These stories depict a system of perversion that, my gosh, it's unimaginable what some of these men were doing. See what I mean? Walking around, and even Congress, this Conyers guy, you know, walking around in his underwear in Congress, I mean, in his office. I mean, my gosh, what are we talking about? These men not caring about decency at all, you know, and the perversions that these women are relating, you know. And then we've got, you know, this senatorial election there in Alabama, and he's been accused also. We'll have to wait and see how that turns out. But we must also remember, and I think Sean Hannity made a good point of this the other night in one of his programs, is that these are accusations until charges are brought against people. And these are old accusations. They're not even, you know, viable anymore as far as legality goes. But, you know, if it's rape, yeah, that could be brought back. That could be brought back. But there are certain, you know, just sexual harassment. It's just an accusation. But these are accusations still, and they're not proof that you would have to establish in a court of law, see. So we're talking about two different things here. And that's not to demean the men, the women that are making these accusations as being liars. They're, some of the best trial attorneys that represent women in these cases, in their experience. One the other night was saying on one of the talk shows that about 30-40% of these accusations are sometimes false, and that's what she's run into, is to get someone back, revenge, or to hurt someone, or for money itself. In other words, someone in a position of power and has a lot of money, they can go in there and try to get some of that money through lawsuits and so forth, through these accusations. And they're not always provable, these actions by men that were trying to take advantage of these women, see. And there again, I mean, they shouldn't even be trying to take advantage of women like this. You know what I mean? It's just sad what the country has deteriorated into. And it's a moral problem. It's a societal problem. We've been debased. The country has become debased in several ways. We've got to try to get back to doing things, you know, that were right for America and right for one another. Quit abusing each other, trying to use each other like many of these stories depict. We need to get back to rebuilding America again, but especially the families. The American public over decades now, especially in the education system, has been indoctrinated with some kind of akin to social and moral relativism. It's where this thing that entered into the school system was like situation ethics, and every situation is different, and that every person can carry their own truth about things. So we got away from any kind of idea about there being absolutes, so to speak. If you try to travel in outer space without a spacesuit, you'll absolutely die. There are natural laws out there that are absolutes. But what this society has been, you could say, cultivated into or seduced into are some very, very broad ideas that everybody carries their own individual truth and so forth. And that I never will agree with. And because there are certain things that are nature-based and physics-based and so forth that we all must agree on as to what reality is and the way it functions. So this thing about social and moral relativism is a construct to try to excuse bad behavior, in my opinion. And so what we have today in this country and throughout the world is we have a lot of bad behavior being excused by very, very bad philosophy, ethical thinking, and moralistically flawed thinking. Thank you for listening.